This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. For more than three decades, Mr. Rogers taught children to love their neighbors and love themselves. And he gave them the tools to be emotionally and socially prepared for life. It was a quiet and gentle program right from the opening theme.
It's a beautiful day in the
state. The landmark television show celebrated its 50th anniversary in 2018, and New York Times bestselling author Gavin Edwards thinks we would all be better off if we returned to some of the wisdom of Mr. Rogers. He's written a book called Kindness and Wonder, Why Mr. Rogers Matters Now More Than Ever. Gavin Edwards, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here.
We all know, if we know him at all, Mr. Rogers is a fully grown adult in his kindness and his gentleness. Talk about the boy who became Mr. Rogers. You do that in your book.
I do. So he was a child of privilege. I grew up in the richest family in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, an industrial town a little bit outside of Pittsburgh. And he had an awkward, unhappy childhood. He was overweight. He was asthmatic. He was a lonely kid who used to sort of like play alone in his attic with his puppets. And one of the things is that, you know, sort of, I think many people have childhoods that are unhappy in one way or another. And, you know, sort of, and Mr. Rogers as an adult provided solace to many of us. But the thing about him is that so many of us, like, we get older and we say, thank God that's over with. I'm not a kid anymore. Like, look, I'm an adult. I can tie my shoes. He never forgot what it felt like, and he was just always very much in touch with, you know, sort of like that unhappiness that he had as a child, and he took it really seriously and met the children for his whole life.
What are the clues throughout his education as he's growing up, the clues that he wants to apply this feeling to whatever career he should choose for himself?
You can see that just like as he gets older, he's very much got, you know, sort of this like hunger to learn what he can. He like studies to be a pilot. He's fluent in French. He studies music, and many of these things end up being deeply informing what he does. But none more so than after he had been making television for a few years, a show called The Children's Corner, which had many of the puppets that we know from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and actually is the show where he first started changing into his sneakers. He was behind the scenes, but he was running around, and he didn't want to squeak on the floors. But after a few years of doing that, it was this charming entertainment, but he knew he wanted to go deeper. And so he went back to divinity school and studied to be a Presbyterian minister. And while he was doing that, he also studied child development. And Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood would not have happened if he hadn't done that.
Yeah, but it's interesting because he does go to the seminary. And again, with all of this in mind, he's got a children's show. It's successful. But how do I go deeper? He studies child psychology, goes to the seminary, but then he graduates and decides not to become a minister.
So he's been going on his lunch hour, but he was, sort of like very interested in like theology. He's interested in eschatology, but he doesn't really want to get up and give like a weekly sermon. That's not interesting to him. It takes him a full year to convince the elders of the Pittsburgh Presbytery, look, I have a congregation already, and it's a congregation of young children watching through TV, and I would like to minister to them through this medium. And, you know, and I'm not going to do it in an overtly religious way, but like sort of like the values that I've learned here are going to inform what I do. And it took them about a year to get their head around it, but they could see his intentions were good. And Mr. Rogers, although gentle, was also stubborn. I think he eventually won them over.
Take us to the launch of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
So Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood starts actually in Canada. He goes up there. He had never intended to be on the air himself. He was happy being behind the scenes, but the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Company, invites him to come and do a show and then tells him, you know what, I've seen how you speak with children. Like, if you just do that into the camera, that is going to work as television. And so he starts doing that and came very close to just staying in Canada and spending his career there. But after a couple of years, decided he wanted to come back to Pittsburgh and started up the show. And at first it was just a local phenomenon, but every kept on discovering it. And every time they said, is there an audience, they would have like maybe like an open house or something, and 1,000 children would show up. And so they say, okay, people are actually watching and loving the show.
And you point out that this is, I mean, clearly this is a man with deep empathy who is on a mission to spread this message that he feels is so important. But you also point out he's an artist. He's somebody who, at one level or another, understands how to put together television and make it work, a medium that he wasn't particularly in love with.
Yes, and, you know, sort of, I mean, the modern parlance is he was a showrunner. You know, he knew how to do that because he had worked in commercial television at NBC in New York, and, you know, he knew how to cut things. And, you know, sort of, it's not something he would, you know, sort of talk with the children about, but he's like, oh, if you do it from this angle and then cut over there, like, he knew how it was going to play. And he took those parts of his job as producer very seriously. You know, he wrote most of the scripts himself, and he severely edited the ones he didn't write. And there was a high level of intentionality in almost all aspects of the show. One of my favorite examples is that, you know, sort of, he was not drilling letters and numbers the way Sesame Street did, but he was also subtly preparing children to read. And he did that by staging the action on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood is almost always left to right. He comes down the stairs to the closet, left to right. The trolley goes to the neighborhood of make-believe. It's all moving left to right to get children orienting their eyes in that direction.
Yeah, and it is fascinating to think about how popular that program was, given where television was in 1968. Things were getting faster and faster. The clips were getting more and more frequent. The jump, the cuts were getting, and that's the thing he didn't like. And he was somehow successful at maintaining your attention without any of those tricks. I mean, that is a kind of genius, isn't it?
There's an episode where he fills up a fish tank. And it takes 3 or 4 minutes, and it's the very definition of dead air. Yeah. You know, sort of, he doesn't have, like, a little song to fill the time or tap dancers. He just sort of enjoys the silence with the children. And I think people really responded to that calmness, which it's very hard to find in, you know, any commercial, like, television or radio broadcast.
No, and I keep coming back to this. It's not that easy, because anybody who's ever seen, you know, sort of student films will tell you that just being boring doesn't work. mean, you got to know how to do it, and that's the genius, and I think that's beautiful. The other thing that you point out in the book, and I hadn't really thought about, was that he hired well. He really knew talent, didn't he?
Yes, and, you know, and he was drawing locally, but, I mean, you know, just sort of like Lady Aberlin, Betty Aberlin, who was sort of like, you know, his sort of foremost, you know, sort of like human woman on the show, just sort of like spotting her doing a cabaret act and saying, like, this is somebody who I think, you know, could sort of like talk with puppets. And it's an unusual skill to be able to, you know, sort of like come on camera, you know, sort of like relate to like Daniel Tiger as a human being and, you know, sort of like have that real empathy in a way that children connect with. The thing he often looked for was musical talent. And he figured that if, you know, sort of like if they had that rhythm and if they had that sort of like cadence, that he would be able to like work with them and everything else would fill in.
And comedy, too. And it's interesting because, again, you think of the pace of that show. He understood that having comic timing was going to be critical for this. I mean, talk about some of the people he found and put in key positions who came from that background.
Yeah, Joe Negri was a musician, but then he had, I believe, Chef Brockett.
Don Brockett, right, who played Chef Brockett.
Had been doing just sort of like a drive time like comedy sketches on Pittsburgh radio. You know, it was sort of like a well-known guy for that reason. And so he just, there was a pocket like in Pittsburgh of, you know, sort of people who were sort of performers, and it basically said, we don't need to like make it in New York, you know, sort of like Pittsburgh's big enough. We can do theater and music and radio and commercials here. And he just sort of like collected a neighborhood.
Francois Clemens, someone else who is a beautiful singer.
Yes, and had operatic training. Met him through the church that he was Standout singer in the church choir that Fred and his wife Joanne attended, and they sort of got to know him that way, and you know, sort of saw the warmth of his personality, and said, "Would you like to come on the show and play a policeman?" And he had to think about it. He wasn't sure, as an African American, that he felt comfortable like representing the law, and decided, you know what, it would actually be a good role model, and it would be better to, you know, sort of have a policeman being friendly instead of turning the fire hoses on people.
Talking to Gavin Edwards, the author of Kindness and Wonder, Why Mr. Rogers Matters Now More Than Ever. And then, of course, there are the topics, and he was not afraid to take on some very deep topics, including death.
That's right. I mean, one of the shows, probably the episode I find most moving, is one he does where a fish in the fish tank dies. And he's very straightforward about it. He's like, hey, it's not moving. He explains what death is. He sees if he can revive it. And then he takes it out to the yard on the neighborhood set, and he buries it and like gives a little speech about it and tells the children watching the show in a straightforward but emotional way, like how much it meant to him when his dog died, Mitzi, when he was a kid.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we have a clip from that. Let me forgive me for interrupting you, but let's play that clip and then we can come back and talk some more.
When I was very young, I had a dog that I loved very much. Her name was Mitzi. Mm-hmm. And she got to be old and she died. And I was very sad when she died, because she and I were good pals. Mm-hmm. And when she died, I cried. And my grandmother heard me crying, I remember. And she came and she just put her arm around me, because she knew I was sad. She knew how much I loved that dog. And my dad said we'd have to bury Mitzi. And I didn't want to. I didn't want to bury her because I thought I'd just pretend that she was still alive. But my dad said that her body was dead, and we'd have to bury her. So we did.
Clip from the PBS show Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, where he talks about death. Gavin Edwards is the author of the book Kindness and Wonder, Why Mr. Rogers Matters Now More Than Ever. Did he get any pushback? Did he have trouble with the network when he wanted to enter into these subjects?
No, he... The most pushback he got from the network early on was just that he insisted the show had to be half an hour. It was cheaper if it had been 15 minutes, and he sort of said, I'm going to do this. But it was clear very early on that, you know, he was an extraordinary communicator and he had a following. He took several years off in the 1970s, and when he came back, he said, I need to be even more ambitious than what I've done. And he started organizing his shows in sort of like week-long themes. And some of them would just be sort of the playground, but some of them would be about conflict or divorce or things that are like heavy material for preschoolers, and just finding a way to, you know, sort of, and one of the things I find so admirable about him is that, you know, sort of, he is always looking for different ways to communicate. And it's like, okay, if you don't understand it this way, I'll try it this way. And it, like, his willingness to come at anything from six different angles just to make sure that, like, people understand him.
There was, we said this is right around the time that Sesame Street is born, and that is a very, very different kind of program, also aimed at children, but it's going to be much more fast-paced. It's going to be using the kind of television that kids are already used to, and perhaps accelerating that. Talk about that. There was a bit of tension. I mean, it sounds to me like the people at Sesame Street were looking down their noses a bit at Mr. Rogers.
Well, Sesame Street, you know, sort of kind of out of the box was a huge hit. You know, sort of, you know, it's funny. It's got, you know, the whiz-bang, you know, advertising techniques. It's got Muppets. You know, what's not to like? Fred Rogers, very strongly felt that what young young children needed was not, you know, sort of like drilling of letters and numbers, but that they needed sort of like the emotional grounding that would then like give them the ability to learn that, those topics. And he respected like the good intentions of the people making Sesame Street, so he would never say an unkind word about it in public. But you could see that, you know, there's sort of like, there's this wariness on both sides of the camp that, you know, he made an appearance on Sesame Street once, and then when Big Bird was making the reciprocal appearance on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, they had a whole lot of back and forth about, like, well, he wanted Carol Spinney to, like, take off the head of Big Bird to show that there's a man inside the costume to demystify it. Carol Spinney was absolutely not. It destroys the magic of Big Bird. And so they had to, you know, sort of say, well, all right, he'll be okay as long as Big Bird only appears in the neighborhood of make-believe. And he actually booked him on the theme of shows that week was competition. And someone asked him about that and said, oh, well, that seems like a deliberate thing. He said, no, of course not. And then when pressed a little, said, well, maybe unconsciously.
maybe a little bit. Rita Moreno also, who is at that time on a show, another children's show called The Electric Company, appeared on the show. And you say your interview with her about for your book was one of your favorites. Tell us about what
it was. I mean, so she's a national treasure, you know, in pretty much everything she does. And so, and she is delightful and sharp as a tack. But she was so happy to speak to me because she was still moved decades later, like, and had just such vivid memories of when she had appeared. She came on and she, it was a family visit. It was her and her husband, who's a medical doctor, and their young daughter. And Rita sang one of Mr. Rogers' songs, It's You I Like. But the main point of the visit was, like, her husband actually, like, opening up, you know, his little black bag and showing the stethoscope and other pieces of equipment. Basically, Fred doing what he often liked to do, which is, you might be afraid of the doctor. You don't need to be. I'm going to walk you through things. And throughout the whole visit, their young daughter was a big fan of the show, but was just sort of like intimidated and shy and spent the whole time clinging to Rita's leg. And Fred, of course, is sensitive to that. And at the end, just sort of gently asks her, would you like to feed the fish? And she does. And then, you know, they say goodbye and go off. And then unplanned, looks into the camera and says, did you see how she was very shy? And did you also see how her parents loved her very much anyway? And Rita just, like, at that moment, you know, just was so impressed, and he had a fan for life, that he was so sensitive both to her and took it as an opportunity to, like, make other children who felt the same way feel comfortable in their own skin. And it was just this, like, great gift that he gave both to their family and to the viewing audience.
Now, I have to ask you this because you say, you know, why he matters now more than ever. I will give you the pushback question. Look, we have a whole generation raised on Mr. Rogers, and here we are in 2019. Can we really learn from him? Is he a medicine?
Well, you know, the counter argument is, could things be even worse if he had never been on the air?
There
but
you go.
It feels to me like, you know, sort of like the news and, like, culture can just feel like this daily drumbeat that assaults us, that, you know, sort of like in my lifetime, things have gotten, like, louder and cruder and nastier. And I like plenty of things that are, you know, like, I like punk rock music. That's fine. Like, it all has its place. But I think that, you know, sort of like our current just, like, public discourse, certainly, but I think that leaks into, like, private conversations, feels aggressive and disconnected. And it's hard for anybody to be Mr. Rogers 100% of the time, except possibly for Fred Rogers. But if even just like a few times a day, people take a moment and say, you know, like, hey, how would Mr. Rogers handle this? Like, you know, how could he bring sort of like kindness and goodwill to this moment that we would all be better off?
That would be nice. Thank you so much. Gavin Edwards, a New York Times bestselling author. His latest book called Kindness and Wonder, Why Mr. Rogers Matters Now More Than Ever. Gavin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. I appreciate you taking the time.
Just ahead, remembering the contradictions of North Carolina poet A.R. Ammons. Stay tuned.
You are special.